for one who has not lived even a single lifetime. You are a wise man, Van Helsing.
Coming to you from the Carolina Asheville, it's the Elitist Bastards, Ken Hankey.
Hello.
And Justin Souther.
Hi.
Men of many words and few syllables.
Way to get pumped up.
So let's start with the film you were just talking about before we started recording. You saw The Big Year.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. What is The Big Year?
It's a bird watching movie.
Wow. That'll drive him into the theater.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't. Has there ever been a bird watching movie?
Ken, could you answer that? Can you think of a...
Well, rather mystifyingly, there was a film adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's novel, Decline and Fall, which, for reasons that no one has ever been able to explain to me, was retitled Decline and Fall of a Birdwatcher, but I do not believe it had anything to do with birdwatching, per se. So I'd say, no, there has never been a birdwatching movie. I have known a birdwatcher. They're odd.
So this may be the definitive film about birdwatching one can find outside of, say, niche markets and PBS.
Sure. I guess.
Apparently there's not much interest in it.
I have no interest in it. I watch it.
So this is Jack Black and...
Owen Wilson and Steve Martin as bird watchers. Owen Wilson's like the asshole bird watcher. He doesn't watch their assholes. He is an asshole. I guess I should...
Well, I should... I mean, he watches the whole bird, you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And they decide to go each separately. Decide to have a big year, which is... The idea is to see as many... different species of birds as possible.
The great crested grebe and...
Yeah, and they learn important life lessons. And that's the movie. I mean, it's mostly made for the elderly set, I think. And even they didn't seem to have...
They didn't go to it either.
I think the problem is they're fine with Steve Martin. I don't think they like Jack Black or Owen Wilson.
All the elderly set I saw were in The Thing, so...
Oh, okay.
It was full of elderly set.
Okay, well.
In your review, you mentioned that it wasn't particularly... It didn't even seem like it was trying to be funny. It seemed like it was actually
It's supposed to be quaint.
Quaint.
And it
Williamsburg
was.
Is quaint. This is a movie.
I know.
Okay.
It was supposed to... It's not like belly laughs besides Jack Black falling down. It's a schmaltzy animal movie. It's by the guy that made Marley and Me.
Birds are kind of hard to get all touchy-feely about.
Well... That's why you have
Jack Black
and Grandpa with a, or not Grandpa, Dad with a bad heart, and Steve Martin not knowing if he wants to retire and from his work in the movie, from movies. I don't know.
The Pink Panther film should have done that.
Well, they didn't.
I know.
So, it's boring. It's a movie about bird watching. Nobody's going to watch it.
It's sappy and it's
Nobody
boring.
Nobody has watched it.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. That's true. This is a major Hollywood release with three theoretically bankable stars. It opened at number 9. Opened. They don't go up as a rule.
Maybe it'll find its...
Its niche.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like there's some similarity between this and another film that you saw this week, The Way, which is another sort of... It's got a bankable star. It's got a director that's not terrible, Emilio Estevez.
The jury's out on that last part, but yeah, I mean... and it's also kind of sappy.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what is The Way? Because it seems like that's out of all the films that have been released this week, and it has the least amount of marketing muscle behind it.
Well, it really has none. I forget who the releasing company is. I think it's PDA, which is almost, you know, not a releasing company at all. Well, they are.
Do they do Senna?
Yes. It is an uplifting, feel-good road movie with spiritual but not especially religious overtones. You know, the minute I saw it, all I could think of was that edition of the Living Bible that came out in the 70s called The Way, with pictures of all sorts of smiling Christians on the cover. It was really obnoxious. But it really isn't like that, which does not, however, keep it from being pretty darn sappy. What you have is Martin Sheen, who is a curmudgeonly ophthalmologist. You don't get movies that, I'll give him credit for that. That's sort of unusual. I can't think that I've ever seen a curmudgeonly ophthalmologist in a movie before. Possibly, I'm not even an ophthalmologist of any stripe, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, he is at loggerheads with his pushing 40 at least son, played by, guess who, Emilio Estevez.
Charlie doesn't show up?
No, Charlie does not show up. He probably could have used a little Charlie. And then tragedy strikes, because while he was out walking the Camino de Santiago, the St. James Way, which is this pilgrim's thing.
In Spain, right?
Yeah. There was a freak storm, and Emilio handed in his dinner pail. So Dad has to fly over to claim the remains. But since there would be no movie if that's all he did, that would be sort of, you know, tepid stuff. Instead, he
it's
has...
It's like the three burials.
Yes. No, yeah, I could see that. That would be sort of amusing. He has the boy cremated and decides to go on the walk himself, leaving little piles of his son at various points along the way. Now, that's not exactly toe-tap and excitement either. So, this means he's going to have...
Is it a spoonful? Is it the same amount every time?
No, it's a little more. It's a more, a little more willy-nilly
like
than that. He doesn't... It's just. It's more like
a
pinch.
Does he have a pepper grinder?
No, he's our... No.
Be tacky.
This is Emilio we're talking about.
That's true. So, he's going to meet types along the way and befriend them. There is the dope-smoking, chubby, altogether too friendly and talkative Dutchman. There is the chain-smoking Canuck lady who is trying to quit smoking. There is the professional Irishman. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, a bunch of types. It really does have the makings of a bad joke. You know, a Yank, a Canuck, a Mick, and a Dutchman. I don't guess there is a derogatory slang for a Dutchman.
Surely.
There must be, but I don't know what it is. Go into a bar. You know, it has that sort of feel to it. But, of course, everybody is not what they seem, and they're better than they seem, and we're going to learn all sorts of things about ourselves and each other.
What did you learn about yourself?
Nothing. I learned that I'm not old enough for this movie. On the trek, and they'll meet some other interesting people too, like a bizarre gentleman who runs some sort of hostel and goes upstairs and plays the parts of both himself and a woman. Don't ask. There's also a thieving young gypsy and his honorable father. It's also, don't ask. It's sappy stuff. But at the same time as I say that, I can say that I can really believe that there's an audience for it. I suspect there are a lot of people who will really like this. Most of the people I saw it with liked it. Marshan Miller was, oh, this is one of the greatest movies all year. And I'm just like...
And for context, that's the film reviewer from Bold Life.
Bold Life, yeah. And I'm just like, you know, which made me overreact and say, good God, Marcy, I was bored out of my mind. And I wasn't bored out of my mind. I was just kind of bored. Because everything it does, I expected it to do, and it doesn't disappoint. The worst part about it for me, though, was Emilio has aged into looking like K.D. Lang. And he insists on reminding us that he's on this spiritual journey by popping up every so often in unlikely places so that Dad can spot him. It's like being haunted by Katie Lang. And it has this sort of air of a family circle cartoon, you know, where Dad, Grandma, and Grandpa are always hovering in the background. I mean, it just did not work for me. But I can imagine a lot of people who will really like this movie. I am not one of them.
You did see some promise, or at least liked the previous version, or previous one that Emilio Estevez made, Bobby, right? Which a film I've not seen.
Which is really funny because this movie's gotten, people have really handled this movie very, very nicely, very charmingly. I mean, and the thing is, I think the film is impossible to hate. But boy, they ripped Bobby to shreds, and I thought it was a pretty good film. So, opinions vary.
Do you think he's growing as a filmmaker?
No, I don't think that's at all what's happened. I think he has just made a film that has a more solid audience appeal. Bobby is a really scattered, it's all over the place, multi character film. And this is much more audience friendly.
Another film you saw this week, which you were skeptical about last week, and it seems like your opinion of after having seen it is about the same, was The Thing.
Yes.
The prequel prelude to
yes,
the
it's Carpenter. A prelude. Yes, it's not a prequel, it's a prelude. It is negligible. It really is. I mean, it was fine. It's not good. It's not bad. It's totally mediocre. I didn't mind sitting through it. I've already forgotten most everything about it. By Christmas, I will forget this movie even exists.
That's why I'm getting it for you for Christmas.
On so many levels, you suck.
On Blu-ray.
You know what it feels like to be strangled with the bare hands?
Huh. I mean, probably, with the bare hands?
Yeah, the bare hands, yes.
Trademarked.
That's right, the bare hands.
Back in Ken's wrestling days, his pro wrestling days, that was his move.
It's true.
The bare hands.
Yes, and it was also right before I demonstrated how to use the human ear as an ashtray. Anyway, this movie It's people running around an Antarctic station trying to figure out which one of them or ones of them are this creature from outer space. It's
probably the one with the big googly eyes.
Well, no, because you see he's a shapeshifter.
Oh.
And he can look like anybody. And he even knows how to act like them. So it's really hard to tell.
So he's like Rich Little.
But they've added this little wrinkle, you see, where he can't assimilate anything that isn't organic, like metal.
So he can't turn into a robot.
Well, he can't turn into a robot. Him. That's one in which is probably an advantage. But they don't explain how he seems to manufacture clothing.
Young Chinese children. Well, he's already assimilated.
He's got that somewhere in the Antarctic.
Yes, he's already assimilated a bunch of Indian kids. He's having
his own slave labor thing going on. Well, that could be. It could be. And then they know how to stitch North Face on things. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'll accept that as a provisional.
This is an advanced alien race, Ken.
It's fine if you like this sort of thing, I suppose, but it really is. It is the classic example of it's just sort of there.
Have you never seen the Carpenter film? Would you like
No, I have seen the Carpenter film.
No, I'm saying if you never had it.
Oh, you might like this better, yeah.
Is this better than Ghosts of Mars?
Yui Boll has made better movies than Goats of Mars.
Is that a yes or no?
Yes, this is better than Goats of Mars.
Okay.
This is spectacularly ept. But it's like I said in the review, you want Norwegian horror, stick with Troll Hunter.
Yeah, are they Norwegian? I thought they were in the Antarctic.
Yeah, they came from Norway.
Oh, okay.
Most of them did.
So they talk like the Swedish chef?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
So there was another film you saw this week that you had very, very different reaction to, judging by your review. It's a film that you seem to think was promising but fairly flawed in a lot of ways. I'm talking about Higher Ground.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, because it's another film that I think has suffered from not having a lot of publicity behind it.
Well, it's an indie title, so of course it's not going to have a lot of publicity behind it. I mean, at least it came out through
Sony
Pictures Classics.
The whole thing seems to be that it's Vera Farmiga.
Yeah, I mean, the big hook is that Vera Farmiga is not only in it, but she also directed the film. This is her directorial debut, as we say, and it's a good, solid film in a lot of respects. It's interesting in that it does discuss the whole concept of faith, in that evangelical type of faith. Which is kind of, I think, hard for... The film is set in, is kind of a period piece thing, and it probably is hard for a lot of people to quite grasp the fact that what she and her husband originally fall into are what, back in the day, like the kids say, we would have called Jesus freaks. You know, they strum guitars, and they're scruffy hippie types, and they talk about Jesus a lot. But the whole thing is really about her trying to maintain her beliefs, or what she thinks her beliefs are supposed to be. When she was quite a young child, she got talked into thinking she heard Jesus knocking on her heart and wanted to be let in. And she's not been able to keep that going, because she never never really gelled for her like it was supposed to. So she spends her entire life trying to make it gel, and it doesn't, and she becomes more and more disillusioned even though she keeps trying. I mean, there are some really good scenes. The scene where her best friend, who has had brain cancer and has been turned into a virtual vegetable state, is sitting in that state in a church in a wheelchair while the rest of the congregation and her husband are you know, accepting this as God's will and singing "It Is Well With My Soul." And there's this splendid watching her face as she's sitting there thinking, you know, that she can't sing with them because it is far from well with her soul. And it's very good in this respect, but it is not particularly disrespectful to fundamentalist Christianity. It just can't accept it. At least her character can't accept it. It was very unusual, because normally you can find all sorts of keen on Jesus movies, and you can find all sorts of satires on Jesus movies, but you don't usually find one that tries to approach the subject from a more balanced point of view, which this does, and sometimes succeeds. The casting has some problems. The guy playing her husband is just bad. And there's something wrong with the... I was never really convinced that the person in question was interesting enough to make a movie about.
And the book is based on the film is based on a book, correct?
A memoir. Yeah, okay. Which comes under the heading of
the Bible.
No, that's okay. That's a collection of short fantasies.
Okay.
I'll get in trouble for that one.
If I have anything to say about it, you will. So,
if you have anything to say about it, I'll get in trouble for being here.
I've been trying for over a year now.
Yeah. Very trying.
So, another film that was seen this week is a proper remake. It's not a prequel or anything like that. It is...
Well, I don't know if you can even call it a remake. If you listen to what Craig Brewer has to say, which is he was calling it more of a revival of Footloose. Which, in a lot of ways, I understand where he's coming from, because he's taken the original Footloose script, tweaked it a bit, and it's basically just Footloose again. Like, there's... I've never seen the original Footloose. I have no desire to see it.
I saw it. It went in one eye and out the other.
Right. From what I understand, there's tons of dialogue that
was
the same.
Was there sparkly stuff during the big Footloose number? Like little spangles of fairy dust? Okay.
They put it into some sort of, like, cotton gin thing that shoots out of...
Oh, I don't think it's ever explained how it happens.
No, they explain it here.
And one thing I do like about Brewer is that, you know, he actually tends to cast honest-to-God Southern people.
Right.
I mean, he's got Dennis Quaid, he's got Andy McDowell, he's got Ray McKinnon. So, I mean, you know, there's a certain feel of authenticity about it. And it's interesting because my wife decided she wanted to see Black Snake Moan this morning, so I'm kind of currently up on my Craig Brewer. Right. And does he, in this film, use the widescreen as well as he does in his other films?
Oh, you don't have scope here, Ken. I didn't notice anything spectacular with it. But, I mean, as far as 80s movies that Craig Brewer should be remaking, this is probably, believe it or not, maybe the one he should. The problem with the movie is it is Footloose all over again. There's some interesting aspects in the way... Since he really, I can't think of anybody other than Ray McKinnon, who's only done one feature that I know of, who we can really call a Southern director. Like, there's nobody.
Is Randy and the Mob Ray's only feature?
That I know of. He did that short film.
The one that won the Oscar.
Yeah.
You might be right. I mean,
there's nobody that's solely handles the South.
That's true.
Or cares about it. Like, it's not...
And does it well.
Right. It's not... There's nothing... It's not dumb bumpkins. I mean, there are some dumb bumpkins here, but there's also intelligent bumpkins. So... It's the view of the South that's very respectful, and yet it's also critical of the religious aspects of a lot of it, because... They're taking the same concept of they've outlawed dancing, partly for religious reasons, and he's sort of examining that and how it's this sort of progressive South and this old conservative South. But yeah, he doesn't completely like dismiss.
I have a friend
religion.
Who will never get over telling the same joke about, do you know why Baptists don't have sex standing up?
Why?
Because it might be mistaken for dancing.
They don't use that joke in this movie.
I'm not surprised.
Would you recommend people see this other than horror completists or fans of the original?
There's better stuff out than it, but it's not as horrible as I was worried it might be. It's perfectly fine. All the cast is good. I mean, the guy who's... What's his face? I can't remember his name.
The Kevin Bacon guy.
Kenny Wormald.
Who they've done up in this sort of like, giving him this.
How do they
James
explain
Dean
the
haircut?
Fact that he's like pushing 30?
They don't. It's a movie, Ken.
Yeah, well.
He looks younger than 30.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, he is. He's like 27, 28.
Okay, but he looks close-ish enough. But he's fine. He didn't embarrass himself. Everybody's all up in arms over it. They've remade this movie, and it's Kevin Bacon's big starring role where he got his start. It's like, what has he done since? Why do we care about Kevin Bacon? I'm sure he's a nice guy. I have nothing against Kevin Bacon, but...
What has he done
his
since?
Career has hardly,
I'm sure he's done things since, I just can't think of anything.
His career has hardly been a paragon of virtue, and we need to, like... hold him up as one of the
well
great
yeah but
actors.
See, I get maybe that's the whole thing. It's like this is all he has to fall back
right.
on. You need to, you know, respect.
He got
this.
Killed in a Friday the 13th.
It was earlier.
Well, he
so did Bing Crosby's son. I mean, it's not like a big deal. Anybody can get killed in a Friday the 13th picture. I'm surprised you haven't done it.
They haven't asked.
They may.
So there is one other sort of kind of, it's not really a remake, it's not prelude or something like that. It's a very unusual film in a lot of respects. And of course I'm talking
well,
about...
Well, partially, it's not, well the film's fine. It's what's been added to it that's unusual.
And altered and cut, things have been removed from it by comparison to the original.
Well, actually nothing has been, we're talking about the Giorgio Moroder version of Metropolis, which is in town for four shows this weekend as it's on Friday and Saturday night. At the Carolina, if you want to know where to go, and it's it hasn't really had, the only thing that's been taken out of it are the intertitles. And it's been put back together in such a way that it has subtitles, which may or may not be, that might appeal to some younger viewers. The film was originally brought out, it has been tinted and toned. It was surprisingly subtly, having just seen it again, I had remembered it being much more outrageous use of spot color, but there's only a handful of things, and they're usually pretty good, too. The big hook that they had for this version of Metropolis was that it was for a new generation. A new generation of 1984, of course.
And can you give me a little context for this? Because you did a very good job in your print review explaining who Giorgio Moroder was and why this...
Well, Moroder, Giorgio Moroder was this record producer. He was a recording artist. He has a very famous recording studio that almost everybody who is anybody has used. And he calls himself the father of disco, which, as I also noted in the review, could get him roughed up in some parts of the world. And he was, at the time that this was made, he was really riding the crest of the wave, mostly due to Flashdance and the fact that he was responsible for the title song. Not the Maniac song, but the Flashdance, Oh What a Feeling song, was, you know, he had written that. And this was a sort of a personal pet project, apparently, and he wanted to bring Metropolis to, you know, an audience of kids who would otherwise, by no stretch of the imagination, would they ever go see a German silent movie. But if you put songs by Adam Ant and Bonnie Tyler and Pat Benatar and Freddie Mercury, etc., on it, it was thought that they would go. And this is also how he got access. And this was sort of part of the problem for purists, was the fact that you now had this movie that they didn't want to touch with a stick, because apparently Lang was against using tones and tints on his films, and almost certainly would have been against the soundtrack, although God knows it's not hard, nearly as bad as that electronic balderdash the BBC stuck on it when about 1975, I think it was. But it doesn't work well. But at the same time, the guys behind it and the people who got Moroder access to footage that had not been seen before, making it a necessity for people that wouldn't touch this with a stick to go see this because they wanted to see the damn footage, may not have approved necessarily of what Moroder was doing, but they knew it was a chance to get a whole lot of people to look at this film that otherwise would not ever have seen it. And it's not a bad version of the film. I mean, it's sort of the Reader's Digest version. It actually makes more sense because of some things that they have worked into explanatory titles, that it makes more sense than a lot of the earlier regular public domain versions did, which frequently had things in them that just did not make sense at all. So that it has more coherent narrative than it pales, of course, now because we have the essentially complete version, which, you know, that's only been, well, it's been a year since we showed it here, and that's only been available for a year or two. I mean, before that, it was various truncated versions, and one much closer to complete version, and prior to that, the only version that had really made any effort to be better than the average PD print was this version. So regardless of, you know, what it does wrong, it does one thing right, and that is it gets Metropolis back on the big screen. And it gets it on the big screen where people who normally would not go to see a movie like this did go to see it. And maybe people will come out to see it again.
So let's talk about the special screenings, starting with the Thursday Horror Picture Show, which is a film that are excited about.
Well, yeah, it's Dracula. It's the Todd Browning Dracula starring Bela Lugosi. It's Lugosi's birthday. I think we figured it out. It was his 129th. And what is there to say? It's Bela Lugosi and Dracula. I mean, that covers a multitude of sins right there. What more do you need to know, really? I mean, it is the Dracula film.
Justin, have you ever seen Dracula? What are your thoughts on it? Because I think we can get a... I'm just curious, because we've got someone... would you call yourself a Dracula fanboy?
No. Okay. I would call myself a Lugosi fanboy.
Okay, so...
And maybe a Todd Browning fanboy, but I would not call myself a Dracula fanboy.
Okay. So we've got someone over here who represents sort of an extreme kind of view. But what are your thoughts on Dracula, especially this version?
I don't know. I didn't really think I was going to talk.
The film has been criticized for a lot of things.
Well, there are issues with it. I mean, it is... Especially if you watch this and like compare it to Wales films.
Which yeah.
came out, it's a lot slower and clunkier, but it is moody.
It's very creepy, I think. Yeah. And the thing about it
and
is...
it does have its issues with storytelling.
It has, yes, but...
It has armadillos in it.
Yes, it does. It has Carpathian armadillos. And that alone should make it
worth...
They've
since gone extinct, of course.
They have, but they had them in 1931. They did have armadillos wandering around in Transylvania. You know, and we have the proof.
And what are your thoughts just on Bela Lugosi? Because you...
I hate him.
I mean, he's just being a contentious bitch.
He's a bit contrarian right now.
Awful.
But he's... I mean, this is sort of his defining... garbage. It's his sort of defining role. It's the film that, it's throughout the rest of his life...
Oh, it's good. Lugosi as Dracula. Exactly. Ken said, there's not, you don't have to say anything else.
No, I mean, if you understand what that means,
you know.
And if you have to have it explained to you, you probably aren't going to get it anyway.
So,
of course, I went on at great length in the paper about the film, so,
Go read that. It's much more eloquent than. I'm much more eloquent,
on paper than I am in person. There's no question of that.
Well, next week's Asheville Film Society screening features another iconic actor, slightly later period.
Willie Best.
Features Bob Hope, who's not someone... When I was growing up, Bob Hope was like the cliche of just like bad, corny, old comedian.
You ought to try some of this early stuff, because he's nothing like that. In these early films, the films from say 1939 through I would go as late as 52 are quite different from the crap that you were exposed to on television, or even those later appalling movies like Eight on the Lamb and Boy Did I Get a Wrong Number, and I can't go on this. It's just too grim to discuss.
So tell me. Make the case, if you would, for The Ghostbreakers, the film we're talking about.
Well, The Ghostbreakers is a really slick comedy horror film. It has an actually credible, really good zombie played by Noble Johnson, whom we've been seeing in films for, oh good heavens, he's the Nubian servant in The Mummy. He's Janosch the Black One in Murders in the Rue Morgue. He's the native chief in King Kong. I mean, this guy got around. And he makes a really creepy zombie. And the whole thing is that the comedy is on a similar footing with the horror. But it is done in such a way that you never get away from the idea that Hope is making these quips. Like offering to sell the, asking the zombie's mother if he could interest her in a subscription to Weird Stories magazine. You get the feeling that the entire thing is stuff that he's saying to bolster his own complete lack of courage. And it's good. It's slick. It's given him a really good comedic partner in the black comedian Willie Best, and. A good romantic partner in Paulette Goddard. I mean, as this type of film goes, it's really hard to beat.
Have you seen it?
I've seen Ghostbusters.
It ain't the same.
Yeah, no, Ghostbusters has sweet special effects.
Yeah.
And Rick Moranis.
Yeah, I remember when Ghostbusters came out, a friend of mine sent me a letter, and it contained the sentence in it, "I saw Ghostbusters. What crap. I'll take the Ghostbreakers any day."
So, coming up this week, there are a number of films. The films that you've already seen, of course, are Higher Ground and The Way, and also Metropolis, I guess.
Yeah.
You didn't seem terribly enthusiastic about Johnny English, the new Rowan Atkinson.
Why the hell would you be?
No one is enthusiastic about Johnny English.
Why are his films so popular outside of America? Because the Mr. Bean movie was unwatchable.
It's a big joke. They make them popular so they'll end up here and we have to watch them.
It may well be. I mean, you know, the really appalling thing is to realize that for everything that can be said against America, we have better taste than a great deal of Europe does.
Fair enough.
I realize that is going to frighten the horses and scare all the people with a terrible sense of cultural inferiority, and there are a lot of them, who believe that if a thing is foreign, it is automatically superior to anything that's homegrown. But
usually
we
they hide that stuff away.
Yes, they do.
They usually don't let Johnny English Reborn get out.
No, well, I mean, the English films are a different matter. I mean, we get a certain amount of crap from England, but we don't see much of the garbage from France and Germany and Spain and Italy. I mean, they keep that to themselves. But they flocked garbage in Europe. You know, The Smurfs was the number one film in Europe for weeks. That's distressing. Johnny English Reborn has been at the top of the UK box office charts for a couple weeks now. That's vile.
And this is I think you described it as basically being...
It's Mr. Bean in a spy spoof. Is what it really comes down to.
And it's not that Rowan Atkinson is a bad actor or that he's not funny. He's been in funny things. He's capable of being funny.
He's capable of being... Even Mr. Bean is capable of being funny, but not in more than a 30-minute dose.
Right.
That's the problem, is this stuff is just silly and stupid, and you drag it out... At least the first film had the decency to be 88 minutes long. This one is 101 minutes or something like that. You're like, no, we didn't need 15 more minutes of this.
You're not watching it. I don't know why you're upset.
Because it exists.
So how does this get made and they can't make another Blackadder, is my question.
Because Blackadder is a cult film. It's a cult show. It comes under the heading of it is for a select group of people. This is...
It's for nerds.
For the
talk
mass...
Talk about
yeah.
on the internet, okay. Steve.
Yeah, this is something that plays to the unwashed masses. So don't take a bath before you go to this.
Speaking of...
I will take
actually,
one after.
Either of the two next two films would work for this transition. Let's start with Three Musketeers, because that is, if anything, an American equivalent. Paul W.S. Anderson?
It's based on the classic novel.
Alexander Dumas,
which they have
right?
been making... I looked, and the first version of any kind of the Three Musketeers is from 1911. So they have been making this goddamn thing for 100 years now.
Do you think they're going to have any product placement with the candy bar?
Doubt it, unless, of
does
course...
Does it have a floating ships in it?
A floating ship?
And like in the movie.
I love Moneyball.
Does the book have
I don't
floating
believe
ships?
So. Yeah. I don't think the book has... Mila Jovovich doing wire work kung fu either.
Are you saying they've taken liberties?
I think they have taken liberties, but it's not even the first kung fu Three Musketeers. There was a picture called The Musketeer, came out in 2001. It was,
Nobody saw that, did they?
I did. I had to sit through it. I called it Crouching Musketeer Hiding D'Artagnan. Or Hidden D'Artagnan. And I have a fantasy, and my fantasy is, as I've said in print, that they have made this movie.
Letters?
No, that they have made this movie to prove that Paul W.S. Anderson can actually make the dumbest version of the Three Musketeers ever.
I'm saying I can make a worse Three Musketeers movie. I can make a dumber one.
They made one starring the Ritz brothers. This is pretty hard to top.
No, I can do worse.
I take it you're not looking forward to this film.
No, I am not.
Three Musketeers starring Nick Swartzen.
Danny McBride.
And...
Seth Rogen.
No. He's too good for that,
Rowan Atkinson.
Rowan Atkinson is too good. As Cardinal Richelieu. Without that, that sounds like a really good casting, actually.
Okay, and then the next one, the final of the three, appears to be... Is it the end of the trilogy, or is this just...
Who the hell knows? If it makes money, there'll be another one. It's Paranormal Activity 3.
They'll have cave paintings in Paranormal Activity 10.
And I think they have interpolated home movie footage this time.
Right.
Which means I believe that they're what they're probably going for
it'll
is...
It'll be a silent film.
No, they'll be soaked for Super 8 movie home
on
movies
those,
next. We don't have to go back that
one
far
of those
yet.
Widescreen camcorders.
Yes,
they had
from
the 80s.
In the 80s, yes. So, in other words, what they've done is they've somehow managed to meld, and considering that the producers are the same, some of the aspects of Insidious with the aspects of Paranormal Activity. Except, of course, Paranormal Activity will still look like a piece of crap because it's supposed to look bad. That's the whole logic behind found footage horror, that it looks like amateur footage. And in the interest of full disclosure,
well, they are amateur.
I have actually worked for, as a writer, the producer of this film.
Really?
Yes.
How does it make you feel?
It makes me feel like I want to slap him.
But
and after I sit through it, I'll probably want to slap Steven even more than I do now.
What's his name?
Steven Schneider.
He's got to eat. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Hey, he produced the second Paranormal Activity, and he produced Insidious. He's eating.
He's got to eat more. This is American.
Does it matter what this film's about? Does it, I mean, it's,
no, what difference? It makes no difference at all.
Because I mean,
it's spooky shit going on in being caught on videotape. Ooh.